The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Monday Space Show program. I am your host. I'm actually the only host of the Space Show. It is great to be here, and thank you all for tuning in and listening. One of my favorite newer guests is on the show today, who I will introduce again in just a moment. I know you're in for a great discussion with him. A couple of quick announcements. If you would like to call in and talk to our guest, Eric Berger, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. So remember, we don't use call screeners, so just be patient, let the phone ring, and I'll answer it and get you up on air as quickly as I possibly can. You can also use email, and that is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And for those of you that are on our website, thespaceshow.com, if you go all the way over to the right, you'll see a bunch of menu items, scroll down to upcoming shows, and you will see the show for Eric. And if you open that show and then scroll down to the bottom for comments, that is our blog. And if you post a comment or question there, I'll get a copy of it right away, and I can read that question or comment on air for our guest as well. That is our website, again, thespaceshow.com. So do check it out. There's a very detailed, comprehensive website newsletter there, and you can't miss the big spot for it, announcing it on the homepage. And everything we do is archived. You can easily listen right off of our website, especially if you have a high-speed internet connection. And you can also download these programs there in the neighborhood of 25 megabytes, give or take. And depending upon your internet speed, you may be able to get it downloaded in less than a minute, but certainly in less than a minute and a half or 2 minutes. There's a menu in the upper left, and under the support menu, we have a Space Show store where you can get things like T-shirts and coffee mugs with the Space Show on it, hats, and all sorts of things like that. So do check it out. There's other links and things of interest in that upper left menu, including the instructions for you to share with people on how to listen to a live Space Show program. And then, again, over on the far right, you have recent shows and upcoming shows. And, again, any time a show appears in upcoming shows, that is also our blog. Just open that show up, go down to comments, and even if the show isn't airing for several days, you can start posting comments on it, and I'll get those comments and can integrate them into our live discussion. Of course, once the show is aired, that is our blog, like most typical blogs, and you can comment on the show that already has aired. Please note that I do make sure the guests see all of the blog comments, but I am unable to promise you that the guests will respond or post a comment or a reply. But I do promise you they see the comments, so keep that in mind. A couple of other quick things that I want to tell you about. We are copyrighted and trademarked, and you're certainly free to download all of our programs. The only rules about all of that are don't do anything commercial with them, don't edit the shows, and then put the edits up on YouTube or any other website of, you know, like that. And then, in addition, written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. And then, in addition, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one, GiantLeapFoundation.org. We exist because many of you do financially support us with your gifts. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction. And if you're a California taxpayer, we are a California public benefit corporation. That's the same as a nonprofit. And you get a tax deduction in California as well. And our parent nonprofit is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. They are the 501c3. So if you have any questions, check them out at OneGiantLeapFoundation.org or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we certainly appreciate your support. And again, it is your support that does keep the space show going. Without it, we will be going, but we will be going in the wrong direction, and we'll say goodbye to the program. So again, thank you all for your support. We do have a couple of sponsors. You can see their banner ads going across our website. We have a couple of new sponsors and renewals that I'll be talking about later on. But this segment of the space show is brought to you by Orbital ATK. They're a global leader in aerospace and defense technologies, the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems and space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And if you've ever been to one of their solid rocket booster tests in Promontory, Utah, I would say they are one of the leading space entertainment, excitement, and adventure companies, because watching a 4 or 5 segment booster test is like nothing you have ever seen before, especially if you like big bangs, because it is really remarkable. AIAA is another sponsor. That's the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, the world's largest aerospace pro society. They have 30,000 individual members from 88 countries, 95 corporate members, and all of these people get together to help shape the future of aerospace on a daily basis, and they advance the state of aerospace science, engineering, technology, and know-how. Do visit them at their website, join it, and participate in their conferences, www.aiaa.org. And our guest today is returning guest Eric Berger. He is the senior space editor at Ars Technica, covering everything from astronomy to private space to wonky NASA policy. Eric has an astronomy degree from the University of Texas, a master's in journalism from the University of Missouri. He previously worked at the Houston Chronicle for 17 years, where the paper was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2009 for his coverage of Hurricane Ike. He is also a certified meteorologist, and he is in the Houston area. And Eric, welcome back to the program. How are you?
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm fine. Thank you. How are you?
Fine. Before I ask you about Elon Musk, what, in your opinion, is a wonky NASA policy?
Is anything having to do with the machinations of Congress and the White House and OSTP and OMB and all that good stuff and trying to figure out where the budgeting process for NASA and other space entities like the FAA go?
So is that your unique term, or did you capture that from someplace else?
Oh, I just came, when I was writing a short file for the website, I came up with that. It's just kind of a, you know, sometimes you got to write about the sausage making that goes into space policy, and it's not as cool as launches or things like that.
Well, this is why you're a journalist and I'm not, because I would have just said dysfunctional NASA policy, but wonky is so much better.
Yeah, right.
We're still getting a lot of talk on the space show, and I guess we probably will be for eons to come, about the bold plans that Elon Musk announced in Mexico to go to Mars. And I know you wrote some articles. People can read them at your Ars Technica site. Now that you've had a couple of weeks to think more and more about it, what do you think? Is this just a dreamy vision? Is there reality to it? Are you excited and inspired?
It's a hybrid of all three of those things, I think. There is some substance to it. Right before the big presentation in Guadalajara, SpaceX did do a full-up test of the Raptor engine. And I think that's significant because the engine is the most important part of any rocket. And so to have a full-scale kind of prototype, or if it was closer to the final thing, to actually have fired it and tested it and not blown it up, I think that was significant. Of course, SpaceX really didn't release any details about the nature of those tests, so we don't have a whole lot of information. And I also think the big liquid oxygen tank that they showed a picture of, which was enormous, you know, that was a real piece of hardware as well. And it was made of the composites that they're talking about that provide strength and at a lower weight for the large interplanetary transport system. So I think, you know, there was some reality to it, but there was a lot of faith. This is a company that you know, whose workhorse rocket, the Falcon 9, has had some issues, and we're not talking about the next rocket, the Falcon Heavy. We're talking about the next rocket, the third generation after the second generation after the Falcon 9. So it's kind of a stretch to go from here to there, I think. And the biggest reason that you have to kind of take this on faith is the fact that there's no funding to really do this. You know, Elon talked about putting a few, you know, maybe tens of millions of dollars annually into the project now, and he hopes to, if I recall correctly, I think get up to about $300 million a year, maybe by 2020 or so. But, you know, that's not enough money to have a credible Mars exploration program. So he's going to have to find a partner. And that's probably some governmental agency. He'd like it to be NASA, but, you know, there's no indication to me, you know, speaking of wonky space policy, there's no indication to me that NASA, the U.S. government, you know, would be interested in that kind of a plan right now.
Did you even see a sort of an official NASA response or anything like that to his comments in Mexico? Was there any official NASA response? I know individuals at NASA commented on it, but what about something sort of officially coming out of NASA?
I saw no official NASA response. I solicited no official NASA response. Had NASA commented on it, it would have been, you know, essentially like SpaceX is a valued partner. And to be fair, NASA, you know, is working with SpaceX. It's partnered with them on the Red Dragon launch. And so, you know, they're supportive, and there are people at NASA who are interested. But the official policy of the space agency is driven largely by Congress right now, and the White House will have a say. And there's no indication, you know, at this time that they're interested in that. For example, I texted, you know, back and forth with one important member of Congress, you know, right after the announcement, and he'd seen a little bit about it. And I asked him, is there any chance you foresee over the next 5 to 10 years that U.S. government would get behind something like this? And his response to me was very, very slim. So, you know, I don't know how he gets there from here.
Now I'm looking at the big picture here, not from the space advocate point of view. Is there any kind of compelling or really winning business case or economic case or national interest case that could move humans going to Mars along with a private company such as SpaceX, or even the so-called NASA roadmap plan to Mars, which is not yet official policy, I guess. Is there any kind of winning case on any level that helps move this along in officialdom?
No, and I think that's part of the big problem. Mars is a nice aspirational goal, but at present it does not fit within the strategic interests of the country. There is no government imperative to make humanity a multi-planet species. That's what Elon obviously wants to do, and that's what a lot of people in the new space movement want to do. They want to colonize space. The government, you know, there's no reason for the federal government to be spending, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars to do that, though. If there's any, you know, if there's any place that's within the strategic interest, it's the moon, because, you know, competitors like China are looking at the moon and sending people there and maybe, you know, building some outposts, you know, in 15 or 20 years. And, it has some geopolitical interest. But that's, you know, that's been the problem for NASA ever since the Apollo program. You know, it's space, militarily, there are interests, but from a civil space standpoint, the strategic interests of space beyond, you know, kind of low Earth observation and satellites is fairly limited, which I think explains largely why we've been remained in low Earth orbit and geostationary transport for satellites and things like that for, you know, 45 years.
So, Eric, help me clear my confusion and maybe the confusion of a few listeners. We hear about a NASA roadmap to Mars for the 2030s. At the Space 2016 conference, there was no shortage of programs and four-color brochures by traditional aerospace and NASA in presentations for the entire Space 26 program. I'm not talking about just the tracks that maybe get between 20 and 100 people at them. I'm talking about, you know, conference-wide assemblies on subjects related to the NASA roadmap to Mars. So we're led to believe that NASA is on track to put humans on Mars. But then this guy who always gives me a hypodermic shot in the butt of reality, Michael Lissner, who's this great space lawyer, says, no, you don't have a space policy until it appears in the national, you know, space policy of the country, until you see it getting line item budgetary in space budgets. And until then, it's just glorious rhetoric. So do we have a Mars roadmap plan, or what's the status here?
Well, I think I'm on Team Michael, more or less, with that one. I know him and respect his work. I mean, I think there's a general consensus in the community, the space flight community, that Mars is the destination goal. That's where humans, you know, really need to go. There is no consensus on how to get there, though. You know, do you go to the moon first, or do you try to go directly to Mars? And this president has seen fit under his administration to put it out there that we ought to go directly to Mars. And I think that's partly because his predecessor said we should go to the moon first. And so the next president may go back, and we may talk about this later in the program about how the next administration may change policies. But, you know, there's no consensus on how we get to Mars. And, you know, there are some interesting starts in the NASA budget. There's this deep attack, you know, funding for assist winners, which is pretty important because this may be the architecture by which we eventually put people in a similar kind of outpost and take them to Mars. So, you know, NASA's taking some baby steps, but, you know, to stand up before a large audience and to credibly say we're on a journey to Mars, you know, it's a bit disingenuous because there is not the funding. There are not the line items. There is not the architecture that's at least been publicly revealed for how we get there. And you know, the first human launches on NASA's vehicles for the Space Launch System and Orion probably are not going to occur for another 7 years. And so there's going to be at least one or two presidents between now and then. And it's just really hard to sustain a program, you know, and Mars landings would come at least two decades from now over that kind of a time period.
Well, I'm on Team Michael, too, and I love having him on the show or calling in. And I really respect his work, though I do know there are attorneys that have differing opinions. But that's what happens. You know, get two attorneys in a room and you get 10 different opinions on the issue. I have a first email from a listener for today for you. This is Dr. Doug Plata. He's a medical MD. I'm not sure if you've met him or if you know him yet, from Southern California. Didn't Elon reference his Seattle company's satellite constellation as the way that ITS would be funded?
If I recall correctly, he was asked about that either in the hilarious / sad audience Q&A or in a media scrum afterward. But he said that was an interesting idea and a possibility, but he hedged on that. I don't think that he said that was a way, you know, that they were going to fund this program. And quite frankly, you know, the significant majority of SpaceX's revenues today, outside of, you know, private investment from Google or from, you know, Elon himself or from other investors, has come from NASA through its commercial cargo and now commercial crew contracts. And I'm talking north of, you know, two-thirds of its funding or its revenues. And so SpaceX does not have the external revenue source from its own activities now, or at least over the next 5 to 7 years at least, to pull this kind of a development program off.
I remember in the actual comment, not the Q&A, but the actual thing, he talked about the massive amount of funding that this would take, and he was pretty clear that SpaceX could not do this on his own, and he was talking about partnering with NASA, maybe even having parts of the mission hardware made at Meshub, for example, or some other place, or even, you know, bringing in international partners to participate in the funding. So he would.
That's a pretty astute observation, I think. I noticed that too. He talked about some of NASA's facilities like Meshud, and he may have referenced Dennis as well, but sort of you know, this is playing the NASA game, right? You build your vehicles at NASA facilities, and it gets Congress on board. If you look at what Boeing has done with the CST-100 spacecraft for the Commercial Crew Program, they've said, okay, I think we're going to use NASA's people to do flight controls because we think that the JSC Mission Control does a good job, and that's, you know, we think we're going to build the Starliner at Kennedy Space Center. And so they're doing their vehicle at NASA facilities. I think SpaceX is probably trying to play the same game, you know, for Mars. But obviously the elephant in the room here is the Space Launch System. You know, that's NASA's Mars rocket. Why, you know, Congress is like, we don't need another Mars rocket. We've got one. We're already building it at Michoud and doing launches from Kennedy Space Center. And so that's the real, you know, SLS really does stand in the way of any kind of NASA funding for the Interplanetary Transport System.
And I would imagine Orion, to some degree, stands in the way, too. It's there.
Well, Orion is not directly in the path because that's not a vehicle anyone's going to ride into to Mars. And my understanding is that, you know, for any theoretical Mars mission, Orion doesn't get taken on the stack to Mars. It gets parked at lunar space somewhere and they ride from a lunar orbit in Orion. So, you know, if NASA needs a spacecraft now to go to cislunar space or if it wants to go be in low Earth orbit, you know, Orion can do that. You could make the argument that Boeing's CST-100 or SpaceX's Dragon could be modified to fulfill that role to some degree. But I don't see Orion as much as a direct competitor to the Interplanetary Transport System as I would see SLS.
Eric, once they start having things made at NASA facilities or international participation, the cost efficiencies that SpaceX is known for in controlling costs and expenses is going to sort of leave. And you're going to see the mission costs start to escalate more on the lines of a government project, maybe not as badly or as quickly, but it's not going to have the cost efficiencies of what SpaceX can do on its own.
Well, you're absolutely right about that, and that's another, you know, pretty one of these. There's so many elements about this Mars plan that are interesting to watch, and that's one of them. But I do think it is significant that Musk recognizes that if he's going to get any kind of government funding for these plans, and as we talked about, I think that's a stretch. But if he does, he's going to have to play the game, and the game is to sort of fully engage with NASA and give its large workforce something to do.
Well, so the choice is to get it done and maybe make a pact with the devil or to pontificate to the end of times and not get it done.
I wouldn't say NASA's the devil. I might say some senators in the South come close to that role, but yeah.
Well, no, that's just a dramatic license. You have a caller on hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to our show. Who are you and where are you, please?
I want to officially welcome you both to Team Michael.
A new name for you. Thank you for calling, Mike. This is Michael Listener. So
the pay sucks, but boy, we have a lot of fun.
Well, let me give out your actual street address so your critics can find you.
That's okay. I know all about restraining orders.
Yeah, well, they don't seem to obey them. Anyway, go.
And the court's just right down the road, and I'm on good terms with the police here in this town too.
Anyway, go for it with Eric.
No, I just wanted to call and say hi, Eric. I know we've communicated a lot on email. We've had a few phone discussions. Did you get that little thing I sent you last week? That little document?
Yes, I did, Michael. Thank you very much. It was insightful as always.
Let me ask you about that, Eric, because the listeners don't know very much about this, because unless you subscribe to Michael's newsletter, you don't know. But listeners, Michael wrote a 7-page legal analysis of the legal obstacles and challenges in the way of Musk trying to do what he wants to do based on the Outer Space Treaty and a couple of the articles that are in it and the role of the United States as probably the authority that controls Musk since he is a U.S. citizen and SpaceX is here in the United States. What do you think of that? I mean, I haven't heard anything like that talked about by anybody, critic or supporter.
Well, you know, before the IAC meeting in Guadalajara, I had heard a rumor that he was going to announce at that meeting that he was going to be launching these missions from some Pacific atoll far outside of the U.S. jurisdiction. I put that to one of my contacts, SpaceX, and he laughed at me and said, no, he's not going to announce that. And obviously he didn't. But Michael's right. There are a number of legal issues that would have to be considered before, you know, this kind of plan would take place. And that's another reason to believe that you know, if SpaceX is going to eventually do this in concert with NASA, it is going to have to get in bed, you know, pretty deeply with NASA and politicians to sort of win them over to this architecture. And I think really that, for me, that was one of the take home points of all this, is that Elon's speech was great for the SpaceX fans, and there are many of them, and I think a lot of things the company's done have been great. But it was really an aspirational speech. It was more of a, we could do this. This is one way I think we could do this. Some of the hardware, but you know, now someone has got to come in and take this idea up and you know, help us get across the line. This was not a speech where Elon Musk was saying we're going to get to Mars in the 2020s. If you read between the lines, it was like, here's how we could get to Mars in the 2020s if. And to solve a lot of those legal issues that Michael raised, I think, you know, you have to do this under the auspices of a NASA, or if you want to get controversial. You know, the one way I could see this really getting done outside of NASA is if there's, you know, a country or two in the Middle East that doesn't really have an existing space program but has a lot of money and decides that they want to have the first person on Mars, because, you know, that's where there's some money and potentially some ambitions. But I just, it's hard for me to see any other, you know, national space agency kind of taking this under its wing.
Well, the U.S. law would still apply because Musk is a citizen and it's made with U.S. components and parts and is fabricated by U.S. citizens. So our law applies, and Michael can correct me on that, to any place on the globe where that kind of a thing would be launched. So he would still need regulatory approval, and that's where the challenges come in.
Yeah, and that's correct. Article 6 has a long reach, and the FAA has basically said that to companies like Virgin Galactic and X-Corp, who said, well, we're going to go overseas, and basically FAA said, well, that's fine, but you still got to come to us first and get our approval, because you still are American citizens, and we have jurisdiction. So yes, that is a correct assessment, David.
What if you just moved SpaceX to Doha?
Well, it's got American components in the rocket, so it's correct me again, Michael. It's U.S. citizen, American components in the rocket or manufacturing process, American labor that made the rocket, and then it applies no matter where in the world you want to launch. There used to be a company in New Space that claimed, I forget which one it was, but I did shows on it when the space show started, that claimed they were going to go to Tonga because the Kingdom of Tonga was going to, you know, launch anything that anybody wanted, and no regulatory approval, no nothing. Just come here and we got a spaceport, which they don't have, and we're going to do it for you. And these guys were saying that they can bypass the law by going to Tonga. And I used to say on the space show, no, you can't. And space attorneys, not Michael, because he wasn't around back then, were saying, you can't go to Tonga as a U.S. citizen. Well, I'll give up my U.S. citizen. Well, you can't, because the rocket has components made in America. You're still subject to the U.S. law no matter where you go to launch it. And if you don't like that, you got to get Congress and the president to change the American law. And that doesn't seem likely.
And, well, it's a matter of the treaty and everything. I mean, and actually, you both have a copy of the pressy. And if you look at one of the footnotes, I actually addressed the Tonga issue. It's a straw man argument. I hear it a lot, and I just bang my head every time I hear it. And I just say, okay, whatever you want to believe. But it goes more beyond what the law, you know, the law. It's about the political aspect of it. There's no way OST countries are going to let a non-OST country start launching rockets from its territory. There will be a lot of political pressure come to bear to prevent them from doing that. So it's a legal and a political aspect that will stop them from actually fulfilling what I believe is a nonsensical idea.
What if you just moved the company there, though? I guess that's the point I was trying to make. If you just, SpaceX is now, or, you know, Space Z, you know, they just up and the key players up and moving and create a manufacturing base there and that sort of thing. I mean, it sounds far fetched to me, but would that legally be possible?
Yeah, they could do that, but at the same time, you're going to have to import things, and countries like the U.S. and other countries can stop stop things from going through their ports and allowing exports to that other country to stop them that way. So there are a lot of indirect ways that there are a lot of direct ways they can stop them, but there are a lot of indirect ways too, either by holding back imports or basically getting resolute telling their citizens, hey, if you're a U.S. citizen, you still want your shipping license, you're not going to be delivering this to another country because it does violate some certain export laws and along that line. So don't underestimate the political force that can be brought to bear in things like this as well.
Yeah, no, it would never get that far because I don't see SpaceX as a law-breaking,
I think SpaceX needs the resources that the United States has.
Right.
Musk would never have come to the United States in the first place to build rockets if he didn't understand that he needs the resources of the United States and basically the support of the United States government to really do what he wants to do.
And his labor base is here, and his manufacturing processes are here, and the financing is here. So he doesn't go to skirt the law. So that's just for people who think he can go do that because he loves to go to Mars. It's just not going to happen.
Well, let me ask Michael one more question. That is, would you contend or would you not contend? That's the wrong word. Would you say then that that there is no chance of this happening unless the United States government is involved in a meaningful way?
Yes, and in two ways, not just in the technology end of it, but we got to sit down with the rest of the country, the OST countries, and say, look, things are moving pretty quickly, because the Outer Space Treaty was basically set up to say basically to prevent colonization. All right, when Eisenhower proposed it, the idea was we don't want people going into space like quote the U.S. and the Soviet Union going out and claiming extraterrestrial areas and creating quote colonies. So that's kind of the underlying theme of the Outer Space Treaty. It's going to take a sit down saying, look, either we're going to make a court amend the Outer Space Treaty, or people get angry at me when I say this, or we're going to just say certain provisions, we're going to start dropping them because what we want to do is not plausible. So yes, you're absolutely right that NASA has to be part of it because the U.S. government has to be part of it, not just because of the domestic support, but to get the international support as well. Colonization is a very, very touchy issue, and we have had our experiences with it. I mean, we were colonies, but the Philippines but the European countries have had long histories of colonization, and it really has left a bad taste in everybody's mouth. So there's got to be, in my opinion, an international consensus about this idea of colonizing other worlds. But in order to get that consensus, you're going to have the U.S. and its diplomatic organs involved. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's perfect. It answers mine. Any other comments from you, Michael?
No, Eric. Just keep up the good work. You're one of the authors that obviously you're a Twitter follower, but you're definitely keeping your head on straight, which is exactly what journalists need to do.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
To you guys soon.
Thanks, Michael. Listeners, our line is available if you would like to give us a call. It is, let me find it here, 1-866-687-7223. Any way you can gauge the public acceptance of the Musk plan? Do you have any feelers out there to sort of, does it go beyond the space community, the space enthusiast community, or even the aerospace community? How do you assess the impact publicly?
I think, to the extent that the public was, exposed to this, it was part of the standard news cycle a couple of weeks ago when Musk announced it, and it got some attention. It was quickly drowned, I think, in the U.S. election in terms of newsworthiness. And, I think this has got to be all very confusing to the general public because the extent that they know about space, they may have heard that NASA has a journey to Mars. They may not. They may think the space program is over because of the space shuttle is not flying anymore. And
you know, it was interesting. I was doing a number of interviews about this when the MUST plan came out, and one of the BBC news people I talked to, you know, right before doing the interview, she's like, you know, I had never heard of the Falcon 9 rocket before today. So, you know, I don't think it made much of a splash in the general public. I just, sorry to say.
Well, it did make a splash in the space community.
Absolutely. It made a big splash in the space community.
You got another question from Doug Plata. Don't forget that the politics can cut both ways. If American political leaders were firmly against colonization off Earth, then they would be going against the desires of a lot of citizens and congresspeople. Instead of America doing everything possible to stop space colonization, perhaps they would be trying to help facilitate companies to do space colonization. And Doug, let's see, the American Congress and President doing things the American people don't want and going against us. Come on, you can't be that naive. But anyway, what do you think? You're the guest of honor. How do you respond to Doug?
I can't really get past the issue of this is not an issue that is at the forefront of the minds of people in Congress or the White House. It has been the policy. I remember a speech Jeff Grayson, formerly of ICSCOR, gave at ISDC, I think back in 2011, when he basically went back and looked at the space official policy of the United States government over the last 20 years. And, you know, as part of that, colonization was part of it, right?
Right.
You know, space colonization. And NASA is talking about space colonization now of Mars, but it's not. They're not doing anything that would enable space colonization. I mean, if you run the numbers on the Space Launch System, you know, that's going to be on the order of $2 to $3 billion per launch. And it can launch four people maybe in the Orion space capsule or six. I mean, that's not colonization. That's reinventing the Apollo program and sending a few people back to space at a time. I mean, you know, it's the Bezos and the Musk and those guys who are trying to master reusable rocketry. That's really the only way to do an affordable colonization program. But you know, the government's going in completely the opposite direction right now, and I don't see that changing. There's no big national imperative driving that would drive that I can see.
A lot of questions. I wish they'd give us a call instead of emailing us. Jerry Everett in Florida. So first of all, I sent a real long email explaining how one could fund this, and I asked him to either shorten the email or post it on the blog, so it's too long to read. But then he followed up with, so back in 2010, when there was a fake competition for the SLS architecture, Musk said he would build the Super Heavy for $3 billion or $6 billion if he was forced to use NASA facilities. Bypassing NASA or international law has been taken off the table. Musk has said all relevant law and treaties will be observed. By the way, lawyers exist to advise you on what is legal and to defend you when you decide which laws you're going to break. Well, I don't agree with that, because often you aren't breaking laws, but somebody else or the government thinks you are, and you get stuck having to defend what you did. But I don't know, any comments on what Jerry just said?
That is a huge issue. The competition, so to speak, for launchers back in 2010, basically when the Obama budget first came out, it was in January, February of 2010, it was the fiscal year 2011 budget. That's when they canceled Constellation. And the basic gist of that budget is, we don't need heavy lift right now. We don't think it's appropriate to be spending, you know, $1 billion or $2 billion a year building a heavy lift rocket when we really don't have the capacity to use it. So let's wait a few years and maybe the private sector can come along and have a heavy lift capability that would do this. And of course, Congress said no way. But if you look now at that decision, at least that part of the plan doesn't seem so bad when you look at what United Launch Alliance is doing with the Vulcan rocket, which has some pretty innovative technology, especially in the upper stage. You look at the Falcon Heavy, which, you know, is going to fly at some point, maybe in 2017, we'll see. And you look at what Blue Origin is doing with the New Glenn rocket, which is this incredibly powerful rocket with these seven VE4 engines. You know, the commercial sector is stepping up with lots of options for medium and heavy lift rockets that would be coming online at basically by the end of this decade. So I think that was a good point. As far as the question of, you know, Musk and legalities, I agree. I mean, his preference by far, I'm told, would be to do this with NASA. But, you know, in 10 years, if he's not getting funding for this, you know, he may, desperate's probably the wrong word, but he may be willing to look at alternatives and willing to push back a little bit against the legal framework. But that's just very idle speculation on my part.
Well, I think the area that you could push back on would be planetary protection, saying, no, you can't put humans in this part of Mars. So that's different than a lot of the issues that Michael legally raised in the seven-page article that he wrote on some of the articles of the OST that seem to regulate and control what he wants to do. But I could see him pushing back on a decision of planetary protection, saying, you can go to the poles of Mars with people. It's cold as hell there, so you can't do much damage with contamination. But nope, you can't go anywhere near the equator. And I could see him pushing back on that and trying to produce some scientific and other evidence to support his being able to do that. Go ahead.
He's been pretty clear on planetary protection, that he does not, that issue does not really bother him a whole lot. He has said as much. You know, there might be some, you know, he said there might be some extant life, you know, down underground, some microbes or something, but, and I don't think we're going to disturb them, was basically his take on planetary protection. And, you know, that's a defensible point of view. His belief is that he's looking to, you know, looking out for humanity. He wants to make us a multiplanetary species. And if, you know, if we have to change the Martian, you know, change the climate of Mars and so forth and possibly affect life there, you know, that's the price of, you know, that's the price of, you know, preserving humanity. And it's a price he's willing to pay. Now, there's a lot of scientists who would disagree with that, but I agree with you. That's one thing where he would be willing to fight pretty overtly against people who would not want that.
So you have an email question from Randy, and Randy is in Ohio. He doesn't say where. And he says, do you think there is any broad-scale interest in going to Mars by either of the presidential candidates? Does this even rate a one-minute comment by either presidential candidate, or have there already been one-minute comments by the candidates?
I think the candidates are both about as interested in going to Mars as President Obama was, which is to say, not really at all. Now, the president wrote a nice op-ed, a pretty well-written, thoughtful piece on space exploration on CNN last week to kind of burnish his legacy in space. But the fact of the matter is, you know, he has not put a whole lot of effort into the journey to Mars, and the next president will probably pay it some lip service, but no, there's no burning passion in either of the candidates to send humans to Mars.
So if they say they're going to go to Mars, or if they say we're going to fill potholes first, which is what Trump says, that's not a big deal based on either of these candidates' lack of interest in going to Mars.
I can say that my belief in talking to a few people who have a tangential relationship to the Hillary Clinton campaign, there is no space policy per se for Clinton at this point. She has, you know, it's just not a campaign issue. It's not something that they've developed a deep policy about. But I'm told that there would be a pretty strong consideration, likely by her, toward a moon-first approach toward human exploration. So Mars, yes, is still the destination goal, but there are a number of practical reasons to go back to the moon first, not the least of which is an opportunity for really rich international cooperation. As for what Trump may or may not believe, he's made the potholes comment about Mars. He said at various times that NASA or that the U.S. has a space program worthy of a third world country, but he's also praised NASA.
my sense in talking to a couple of people in Republican space policy circles is that he would be more interested in letting, you know, Congress kind of drive the bus on NASA policy. And, you know, as we saw with this year's budget in the House of in the House of Representatives, at least, there is some bipartisan agreement by Republicans and Democrats that, you know, we ought to use the SLS and Orion to go back to the moon first. So I think that both candidates would at least have a real interest in entertaining that idea. And I think you would pay some lip service towards saying, yes, we're on a pathway to Mars, but there are a lot of good reasons to go back to the moon first.
Interesting. You have another caller on hold. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Jerry Everett in Merritt Island, Florida.
Ah, good. You did call. So great.
Yes, indeed.
Go for it, Jerry.
Well, okay. The gist of the list of funding sources that I sent in for the ITS was just really, I did that beforehand to clarify it in my own mind. I see a big potential for him to develop that second stage spaceship for the military as a rapid deployment and rapid extraction device for special operations units anywhere in the world. We've had for some years now a strike from the homeland effort going on is to see what we could do to reach other countries and touch them from the homeland in the event that we don't have a lot of bases in the future abroad. And I know twice, and I think you were involved in one of the efforts, were to discuss the possibility of a suborbital military transport.
Yeah, the Marine Corps sustained effort about 5 or 6 years ago out of Lackland Air Force Base, but that ended up going nowhere, unfortunately.
Right. As I understand, it was because, A, we didn't have the technology, and, B, to develop the technology would cost an enormous amount of money.
I'll take it a step further, Jerry. It died because it did not have the right people and leadership involved at the top.
Well, okay. Elon is possibly somebody who could talk to the military and say, hey, look, we got your answer. He did talk a little bit in the presentation about using that second stage as a suborbital platform here on Earth, but his focus was on the commercial use of it, but I think it's more appropriate for the military.
Eric, any comments?
Oh, that's an interesting point. I am not an expert on point-to-point suborbital transport. I've been told that economically, at least from a business standpoint, doesn't make sense, but the military has a lot of money, so that negates that. I really don't know much, to be honest, about military contracting, but I will say this. The one thing that Elon Musk has unquestionably been a master of is the ability to take federal contracts for programs that the federal government wants, like low-cost cargo and crew transport to the space station, and essentially bootstrapping those technologies into the stuff Elon really wants to do. And the prime example of this, the amazing thing is that, you know, with the Falcon 9 rocket, when they were starting to fly cargo flights for NASA, so NASA was paying them to fly cargo to the station, you know, SpaceX is using those funds in part and those opportunities, pay for opportunities for spaceflight, to practice for Mars. Because the very first boosters, you know, that he was flying up there, he was trying to land or he was gathering data, and he was also taking a bunch of data on his thrusters as they went back through the upper atmosphere where it was essentially the same density of the Martian atmosphere. And so, you know, he's a master at taking kind of federal money and doing what the federal government wants, but also sort of having this long-range vision. So maybe military contracts, you know, are one way he sort of helps pay for this technology. I don't know. I mean, I do know that if he were to build an ITS to actually put 42 engines together and launch a demonstration flight, you know, somehow or some way, that would really change the conversation. But he's got to build that first rocket somehow, and he's got to figure out a way to pay for it. And maybe giving the military what it wants in some form or fashion is one way. I don't know, but that's a good thought.
Yeah. Well, another thing I wanted to ask you about Johnson Space Center and its future. It's a little different subject, but I saw the speech that the fellow from Johnson, I'm sorry, I forget his name, at the Marshall, Marshall meeting that they have every year. And he was saying that, you know, that Johnson was down to like its last area of focus in terms of communication, so forth. And that he was concerned that they would, you know, that would be taken away from them by these commercial element, you know, as commercial companies who do their own earth-to-space communication and so forth. You're down there. What do you think? Is Johnson in threat? You think Administrator Garber will take away their franchise?
Well, first of all, Lori Garber is not, almost certainly will not become the administrator of NASA under a Clinton or a Trump presidency.
No, why do you say that under Hillary? They're really good friends.
They are friends. There would be a very big battle to get her confirmed. And I was told from many people that is unlikely to happen. Now, what is more likely to happen is that the space council gets
Donna Edwards.
I'm sorry?
Say again, please.
Donna Edwards.
No. I was saying she could come back and she would likely have an influential role. She could have an influential role either in like a space council, reconstituted space council, or an OSTP, or some position at OMB, or some kind of new space level, you know, senior position in the government. So she will have some influence. As to the future of Johnson Space Center, you know, it's a big concern. I have a lot of friends at JSC, and there are many causes. There are many signs of concern. You know, back in the mid-2000s, during the heyday of Constellation, they had three major programs. They were flying space shuttle, they were managing the International Space Station, and they were overseeing Constellation, the development of the Ares rockets and the Orion spacecraft. And by 2012, the only program left standing was the International Space Station. Constellation and the shuttle were gone. And so you lost two of your three main programs. And the funding, you know, your funding levels declined. And what do you replace that with? And another big issue, which is, you know, really made me scratch my head, the commercial crew program, right? The commercial crew program to get astronauts to the International Space Station and Johnson Space Center's home astronauts manage the International Space Station program is not managed in Houston. It's managed at the Kennedy Space Center. And that's another kind of big warning sign. So I think there are some very legitimate questions about the future of Johnson Space Center. And, you know, we'll see what space policies the next president takes. I think if you were to do a lunar return program, I think that would be pretty beneficial ultimately to JSC because it would mean probably more flights and more missions and more things to do. But, you know, that's a very good question, and I'm not overly optimistic.
Hey, Jerry.
Yeah.
As an aside, and I'm not going to use names because I don't know yet that I have permission to use names, I'm contacted by the CEO of a private company that is already sending commercial communication messages to space, totally commercial, and their goal, and he wants to come on the space show to talk about his company, their goal is to do exactly what NASA is doing with messaging to the astronauts and to hardware as well, except through their own commercial facilities, which are modern and can do this at a much, much cheaper cost. So he claims their future is extremely bright, and, you know, they can offer and do what NASA's doing at a much cheaper, more competitive price. So I thought about that when you mentioned one of your issues with JSC, and I'm thinking of putting him on the show, but we haven't decided to really do that or not, because, you know, I think he may be a little bit ahead of the market, but maybe with what you're saying, he's not that much ahead of the market.
Yeah, that's a laser Tedris.
And he mentioned, you know, that they're better than that.
That's it. Johnson has one trick, is a one-trick pony now, and that trick is about to be taken away. And I think they need to look around and see what is it we can bring into Johnson to save us, to have something, a place to go. Because at one point or another, there's going to be another BRAC commission. And, you know, unless Johnson has something to sell, you know, it'll be a museum.
I wouldn't go that far for a couple of reasons. First of all, if you're going to have a BRAC commission for NASA, and I don't see any appetite in that for a new presidential administration or in Congress, that could very easily be sold as this person is trying to, you know, minimize or reduce or harm, you know, America's crown jewel, you know, NASA. It's hard for me to see there being a BRAC. If there were a BRAC, you would look for places like maybe, you know, Glenn or other NASA centers before you would look to maybe JSC or other places like that. But you know, you're right. JSC is not a one-trick pony. It trains astronauts. But, you know, the mission control is obviously a huge part of what JSC is known for and what it does today. Although they did get significantly downsized after the shuttle retired. I think their workforce in mission ops was cut in half or something like that. I don't have the numbers exactly in front of me.
Texas is a very entrepreneurial state. Why aren't you out there grabbing all these new space companies and offering them little incentives? Come do your stuff here. Build Johnson from the outside in.
Because it's hard to get inside the fence, although they're trying to address that. And, you know, to some extent, Congress is, and this is the reason why I don't think Johnson's in any real peril, you know, anytime soon, is Congress is not going to say, we're not going to turn our astronauts over to some private company.
Especially
you know,
not
we're, you know,
proven, yeah. They're
we're
going
to rely on, you know, the Chris Kraft and the, you know, the other legendary flight directors, the Gene Kranzes. You know, we want these people looking out for astronauts. We don't want some private company who's, you know, trying to save a few bucks. I could be wrong, but that's, I have a hard time seeing Congress or even a president, you know, taking that route.
Well, I hope that Johnson does well and that they do grow themselves. I mean, you know, there's the Ford and there's General Motors, and you can choose which one you want to be.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I hear you. And I don't disagree with your basic premise.
We saw that here at KSC. I'm on Merritt Island, and we're building a big time. We're going to have Blue Origin manufacturing rockets and engines here, and we've got the B-2 follow-on being put down and being manufactured in Melbourne. And Embraer, we saw that through the downturn where we were really crushed. And we knew we had to build an infrastructure that was just bigger and draw on that. And Kennedy, KSC is looking good. So
I don't disagree with that. It's boom times for KSC and for Marshall Space Flight Center. And of the three main manned centers, Johnson is down now. That could very well change in the next, you know, under a new president or, you know, a new Congress could flip the script on that again. And I would just say that at least for the next 4 to 5 years, assuming Congress or the House remains in Republican hands, the chairman of the Budget Committee that oversees NASA budget in the House, the subcommittee of the appropriations, is from West Houston, a guy named John Culberson. And, you know, he's going to protect Johnson Space Center while he's in power. So,
well, and he's going to take us to Europa too. So as long as
well,
he's
that too,
power.
Yeah, which is great.
Yeah, I think there's very good chance that Clinton will win the presidency and that Democrats will take the Senate, but I don't think they'll take the House. So
yeah.
You got some protection, you got some time, but don't, I'm just saying, like people in Texas, some of whom are my relatives, they need to get on they need to get ahead of the game. But
four years or eight years from now,
the time will come when you have to move.
Right. I mean, what happens in 2024 or at the very latest 2028 when the space station stops flying? Then what are you doing? That's a good point.
The first thing they tell you about combat is never hunker down. that get up and flee forward, even though everything in your body is telling you not to. That it's hunkering down just allows people to zero in on you. That your best chance of surviving and doing what you're supposed to do is get up and flee forward. And Johnson needs to get up and flee forward.
Well, I think a lot depends on who is the head of these places. Like when NASA Ames had Pete Warden head, it was really an innovative space age, space center. You know, unbelievable. And I think a lot depends on who gets appointed to be the director of these centers and what their philosophy is. So that's something to consider, too.
Yeah, and we have Bob Cabana down here in Kennedy, and he was just the right guy. And a lot of what happened down here was they started selling off and leasing facilities on Kennedy to private contractors to do this, that, and the other. And that's worked out very well for them, and they're still going strong with that. This and the rocket, the Musk's transport thing, that's going to be assembled on site. It'll be parts of it built elsewhere, but it's too big to be transported. It'll be assembled on site. So they're already talking, I understand, about the 39A and what the limitations on there, and maybe they want to let SpaceX build 39C. You know, it was originally supposed to be a three launch pad system there for Apollo, and they cut out one of the pads, but the place is still there. So they may actually have two pads instead of 39.
Jerry, I got to move on. Is there anything
else? Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, I just wanted to call in.
Thank you very much for your call.
Okay, bye-bye.
So, listeners, that line is available again if you want to call in 1-866-687-7223. Eric, I was going to take a break, but we're way past that point. Are you good to keep going without a break?
I'm fine to keep going, yep.
So I have another email, and this is from Helen in Seattle. And Helen says, do you see any competition or competitive threat that the U.S. decides it needs to compete against China for their space policy? I see they just launched two Taikonauts yesterday or today.
I don't see that card was played by Michael Griffith when he was the administrator of NASA. Congress recently held a hearing to that extent. Right now, I don't see that driving the space policy discussion in the United States. And it's arguable, it's debatable as to whether or not that changes when China sort of talks openly about a lunar landing for Taikonauts and, you know, maybe at the end of the 2020s or something like that. I think that's an issue that's kind of simmering in the background right now. And I think it may be one of the reasons why ultimately the next president decides to have some kind of a lunar program before going on to the moon, because we really don't want to be, you know, flying around in cislunar space while the Chinese are contemplating landings on the moon. That would be a pretty bad look for the president.
But
I don't think it's driving things right now.
Do you think Clinton or Trump, or have they ever thought about it, or did any of your sources give you any information about whether they'll break this ban about NASA talking to China? I know it can be skirted and worked around, but do you think they might try to get that law changed?
I have no information about the Trump presidency, although giving his attitude toward China as kind of a big, bad, evil currency manipulator, it's hard for me to see that he would take a proactive approach on that. I know that President Obama has wanted to change that, and I have full confidence that a President Clinton would want to change that. But there are key people in Congress, like before mentioned, well, it started with Frank Wolf, but John Culberson now holds his position as chairman of the House subcommittee over the NASA budget. And, you know, he feels the same way Wolf does. He's pretty adamant that, you know, if we start working with China in space, they're going to steal all of our technology and then, you know, go off and, you know, do their own program. So I see the White House wanting to do that. I'm not sure that you can get past a congressional roadblock, though.
Well,
I don't.
You know, Trump thinks he can negotiate with everyone, so he might be for lifting that ban and believes he can sit down and talk with China and work out all our competitive differences. I don't know. I mean, that's
well,
what
that's,
he talks
that's,
about.
That's true. That's possible. But, you know, like I said, I'm sort of led to believe that a Trump presidency would largely space Congress. And, you know, Congress, the writing on the wall is pretty clear from them that at least on the Republican side, they don't. And again, that might change. If the House were to unexpectedly split Democratic now or in 2 years or in 4 years, that might change. But as it stands right now, Republicans there just don't have a real appetite for that. So, you know, you see Charlie Bolton try to do things like go to China. You know, I think NASA tweeted out a congratulations yesterday after the Shenzhou 11 launch, but they're very constrained. I mean, they're not allowed to spend money on activities with China right now. And until that law changes, and maybe it would as part of some negotiation, but until that changes, I just don't see that happening.
Maybe Musk goes to China and gets them a big partner in his deal pending U.S. government approval, and then you really see the pressure come on. So.
Well, you know, I thought about that, but, you know, China has their own space program, and so I'm not sure they're going to want to turn over their funds to some American capitalist when they're trying to promote a different system.
Absolutely. I don't think Musk would turn over to the Chinese system either.
I don't either.
Here, you have another caller on hold. Let's see. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Doug from Southern California.
Go for it.
Eric, I was in D.C. about 3 weeks ago and sort of doing some personal lobbying. Met with eight of the staffers on the House side. Staffers of representatives who are on the space subcommittee. And when I was speaking with them, and in particular the staffer for Rohrabacher, that staffer pointed out a couple of things, which I'd like to ask you about. One of them is he said that sort of in the era of continuing resolutions that we cannot expect an increase in NASA's budget, like adding a new program, like a return to moon program. And he said, number two, the program of record, the journey to Mars, he says, in my sense, it seems like it's correct, that has, a fair amount of bipartisan support. I think the Republicans, a number of them are wishing that we could return to the moon, but they don't want to give up Mars either. So, what Rohrabacher staffer challenged me, I didn't really have an answer at the time, was how can in a continuing resolution sort of environment, how can you make the case that taking money away from the Mars program to put it into lunar return program or taking it from some part of NASA to have lunar return, how does that advance the program of record, the journey to Mars?
Well, that's interesting coming from Rohrabacher's assistant,
yeah.
Because obviously he's one of the very few people in Congress who's been critical of the space launch system. Really kind of the only one that I've been, found that's actually gone on the record and say this is an extravagance that NASA can't really afford. And my only response to that would be is, we don't have the funds right now for the program of record. And so I think in that being the journey to Mars, we just, we're not funding, if you were to deorbit station, next year, then you would have, $4 billion potentially new to play with that you could put in and have a credible Mars program. But if you don't do that, and in this era of continuing resolutions, you're not going to get $4 billion more for NASA. Now, you really don't have a credible program to Mars if you're basing it on, well, we're going to get inflation, and then, by 2040, we're going to send humans to Mars. I mean, that's just, That's a hard sell to a new administration. I think what you're going to find is that the new administration will come in and say, well, Mars is nice, and we want to go to Mars, but we think we should go to the moon first. And then you just take the money that you're spending on a quote-unquote Mars program now and put that to the moon, a moon-first effort. And frankly, when you look at all the things that NASA has done to date in terms of funding for SLS, Orion, and now the Cislunar Outpost, the Deep Space Habitat, all of that money, whether you go to the moon, surface the moon, or to Mars, none of it's been wasted. They've been destination agnostic in those funding and the decisions they've made so far. So what I'm saying is that, they're not taking money away from Mars to go to the moon
because there's no really money being spent right now to go to Mars. They're just spending money to have some kind of a deep space exploration platform, and that could be applied to one destination or the other.
Eric, do you think a SLS-centric and government-centric and maybe international-centric approach to lunar return is the most cost-effective way of going to the moon?
No, definitely not. I mean, the most cost-effective way to go back to the moon would be to say to ULA and to SpaceX. You know, we like Vulcan, we like Falcon Heavy. You know, we're prepared to spend $200 or $300 million for a launch for such and such cargo, and then eventually some kind of crew vehicle. You know, by the end of the decade or in the early 2020s, and there was a study that NASA funded by Charles Mill and other people that kind of looked at that architecture and found that, you know, within about 10 years and within the existing NASA budget, you could have a pretty robust lunar program by the end of the 2020s. It is the most politically pragmatic approach, though, and I say that for two reasons. First of all, Congress is 100% on board. Well, Rohrabacher accepted, but almost 100% on board with SLS and Orion. They've issued a number of statements basically to the new administration saying, we like our plan, we like our architecture, we like our vehicles, don't change them. I don't see that changing really. And if you're going to go to the moon, that's politically pragmatic because, you know, there's the international community, Europe, Canada, some of the other partners are really interested in the International Space Station partners are really interested in going to the moon. And less so, I think they see Mars maybe as kind of a little bit unrealistic. You could do an International Space Station type coalition or program, you know, for lunar exploration over the next 15 years. You know, the director of ESA has talked about the Moon Village and so forth. And so, you know, I just think politically, then you would get some continuity from administration to administration if you actually had sort of detailed commitments to international partners to do this. So I don't think that is economically the best approach, but politically, certainly, that seems like the best approach.
So would you have to sort of retract what you said before, and that is if we were to repurpose the SLS and Orion to go to the moon, that would not be money wasted, when in fact you're saying that it would not be a cost-effective way. So as we continue to use...
Okay, I would clarify that. I would not retract it, but what I would clarify and say is, in the realm of NASA's budget today, that money would not be wasted. Because if you are going to use SLS and Orion over the next 15 or 20 years, the funds you have spent to date on their development could be used to go to the moon or to Mars. It is money wasted. If you're just looking at saying, what is the least expensive way to have a credible moon program, is not to build SLS and Orion. It would be to buy your launch vehicles from the private sector.
So, Eric, here's what I'd rather see happen. I'd rather see SLS be tasked strictly with going to Mars, because I don't want to get in a situation where we are donating SLS flights to the moon. We have a very expensive international coalition base that we have to keep resupplying on the moon. To me, that seems like a recipe for very expensive lunar development, which could can slow the journey to Mars as well as, you know, give us a very expensive lunar base. I would rather see the heavy lift vehicles targeted to Mars, where I think it needs to be. But the moon, I think, should be a public-private program. It could be an international sort of lunar COTS, where just like the current public-private programs to the International Space Station low Earth orbit, that we have a similar sort of thing for development of low-cost landers, reusable, aiming for the ice at the poles of the moon to refuel the landers and create a fairly inexpensive, you know, relatively inexpensive transportation system to lunar surface run by companies supported by different countries, and then a international lunar research facility can be added to that. They can use that transportation infrastructure to achieve the investment goals of the various countries.
Under your idea, when would human missions to Mars begin?
Depends on what you mean by human missions to Mars. If it's a flyby, do you consider that a human mission to Mars?
Yeah, sure.
I think that would need SLS and Orion, and I think that's going to be ready in the early 2020s.
2020s?
For a flyby mission?
For Mars?
Is,
no, we're not going to fly. We're not even going to fly a moon flyby mission until the early 2020s. There's a whole suite of technology you need to get from a moon flyby mission to a Mars flyby mission, the least of which is some kind of, you know, in-space habitation that's going to,
in-space habitat that's
going to keep astronauts alive for more than a year in deep space. I think the earliest that NASA has talked about a Mars flyby is the 2030s, the mid-2030s. And let me tell you the problem with using SLS just for that, okay? The space shuttle, when it was flying, and the space shuttle is to some extent a comparable vehicle to the SLS. It had fixed costs every year, whether you flew it or not, of about $2.4 billion. Okay? So let's say that NASA has become more efficient since then, and the SLS is a little bit easier to keep the supply chain open. And they have said they'd like to get their fixed costs down to about $1.5 billion a year. So between, let's say that there's, just for the easy purposes, 20 years between now and the first Mars flyby mission, you're paying, you know, fixed costs every year of $1.5 billion for your rocket that you don't need for 20 years. So that's $30 billion that you've just taken and you know, not used. And so that's the real problem with, one of the real problems with SLS is if you were not really using it to go to Mars, then you really don't need to build it, because you don't need that. The private sector can build you moon rockets.
If we are committed to going to Mars, how do you get to Mars without a heavy lift vehicle?
Well, you don't. I mean, you don't. I mean, but do you need to carry those fixed costs the next 20 years?
How else do you get to Mars without a heavy lift vehicle?
Maybe you start building it in the late 2020s. I don't know. You don't need it right now. That's the point I'm making, is that it's a very inefficient, the way they're doing it now is very inefficient cost-wise.
Yeah, so we're basically looking at the money freed up from the decommissioning of the International Space Station, and that money goes to develop the deep space habitat and lander.
They're spending some money on deep space habitat, but I agree with you that whenever ISS gets decommissioned, and if you can convince Congress and the President to take all of that $4 billion a year and put it into an exploration program, and it's probably a struggle to do that, but then you do have a credible Mars exploration program. I agree. But that's not coming. Probably NASA doesn't want to decommission ISS till 2029.
Yeah. Well, the other countries, I don't think, are going to go along with that. But
probably not.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for addressing my questions.
Thank you. Good talk.
Thank you, Doug.
Okay.
Listeners, the line is open if you want to use it. 1-866-687-7223. Doug's comment, which was also discussed with him as the guest yesterday on the show, brings to mind a comment that Casey Dreyer said on the space show a couple of weeks ago. So I assume you know Casey, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So we were talking about this SLS issue and all of this, and he made the comment, and hopefully I'm doing it justice so that you can either agree or disagree with the comment. It was kind of an eye-opener for a lot of us, you can talk about SLS and being inefficient and not economical and all that, but there is a part coming out of Congress that something like SLS is the only reason that some of these other missions that we like are getting scheduled and done. So there is a political component that outweighs the economics and maybe the technology and engineering of a mission, and often it's the political part that drives the existence of the mission to begin with. So SLS is political in Congress, and because they're doing SLS, you've got other missions that they're willing to consider and do. If you cancel SLS, probably the other missions die away too.
I agree with Casey.
Really?
I think that's right. I mean, I think that's right. Absolutely. I mean, if you look at, there's essentially a quid pro quo in Congress between the Senate and the House. So the House has expressed an interest in planetary science, and we talked about Culberson and his fascination with Europa, but other members of the House Science Committee are interested in planetary exploration too. And the Senate, Shelby's committee, and whether he's still in charge of that committee in next year, you know, we'll find out in a few weeks, but know, his interest obviously is in SLS, SLS, SLS. And so the deal is he'll agree to putting more money into a Europa mission that until a couple of years ago NASA said it didn't want, as long as it launches on SLS. So if you look at the House bill authored by Culberson, it says this mission must launch on SLS. And now there's two of them. And so absolutely, this is all politics, and that's just how it is.
So the fact that you could do a much more efficient bang for your buck mission with, say, Falcon Heavy or something else, or the new Glenn if it gets built or something of that nature, doesn't enter into it because it doesn't have the political component that drives the mission in the first place.
So I'm going to say something. I've said many things controversial, I'm sure, already, but I'll say one more thing that's controversial.
Okay.
I suspect that obviously funding for SLS is going to continue for some time. There's just too much congressional support for it on both Republican and Democratic side. However, if you get to a point in the early 2020s where you're flying the Falcon Heavy at $200 million a launch or $250, and then you get a second rocket like New Glenn, which is in the same class in terms of payload as Falcon Heavy, which means it's probably a little less than SLS, but you've got two rockets that are reusable because New Glenn is nothing if not, the first stage is nothing if not designed to be reusable, just like Falcon Heavy. The optics of that will be such when you have three rockets launching from Florida Space Coast, you've got Falcon Heavy, 54 tons to low Earth orbit, you know, at what, $250 million? I don't know. I know they've published numbers, but they've gone up a little bit. New Glenn, same price point, 50-some tons. Maybe they have not released the payload capacity. It's somewhere between 30 and 70. So we'll say same price as Falcon Heavy, same price, $250 million. And then you've got SLS in 2023 launching people. Same price, but it's not $250 million. It's 10 times as much. It's not reusable, so you're not getting anything back but the capsule. At that point, funding for SLS, if the vehicle does not become more efficient, goes away because the private sector will have proven that it is capable of building a heavy lift vehicle. And I have been told by people at Marshall who are big SLS supporters that if you get to the point where the private sector shows it's capable of building this class of vehicle and can fly it and can reuse it at such lower cost, then SLS politically does go away. But until then, it's the law of the land.
So what about these billions and billions and billions? This is where we need Carl Sagan to tell us how much we've spent on SLS. And who is the president that's going to have the balls to go, poof, bye-bye, we don't need it anymore, it's to hell with the $100 billion we've spent on it or whatever? I mean, is anyone going to have the guts to really do that?
I think so. I mean, it's the whole sunk cost fallacy. You know, at that point, we'll have spent, I think it's, what is it, $13 billion for SLS and ground support systems at the Cape by 28 by EM1. And so if you figure another $2 billion a year, so, you know, you're looking at $20 or $25 billion spent on SLS and the ground systems by the early 2020s. I just, at that point, you know, common sense would prevail. And I think that, you know, but until these rockets start launching, right, is the Falcon Heavy ever going to fly? Is New Glenn going to fly? Is SLS going to fly? I mean, they've got to start flying. But once you sort of get hardware flying, I think the discussion, you know, really does change. And there's an acknowledgement of that at NASA, believe me. Oh God, I just said believe me, which means I'm not saying it. But no, I have talked to people at NASA, you know, who have sort of deep philosophical discussions about this, and there is a realization that they have got to get their fixed costs down. Because this isn't the 1980s or 1990s when there was no alternative to the space shuttle. There's potentially going to be two commercial alternatives, and they're going to be launching from the same place. And at that point, I mean, everyone's going to see, you know, if SLS costs twice as much, okay, it's defensible. But if it's 10 times as much,
so how do they drive those fixed costs down? They're fixed costs for a reason.
Well, I will tell you, they're trying. They're looking at it, they're trying. Bill Hill, who oversees SLS and Orion and the ground systems for NASA at headquarters, told me we were sitting at a cafe table in Michoud.
And I'd asked NASA for fix for SLS, and he finally told me, look, we want to get to $1.5 billion a year for SLS, Orion, and the ground systems. And that would be, if they could get there, that's a good start.
Maybe they ought to import some laborers, so maybe work it that way. I don't know.
But there is a recognition that, you know, that they've got to perform, and they've got to do it in a cost-effective manner. And that they see SpaceX, and at one point it was possible to dismiss SpaceX. Well, you know, you could dismiss one, right? You could look at Elon and say, well, this guy talks big, and he delivers sometimes, but, you know, where's the Falcon Heavy? They're never going to get 27 engines to fly at the same time. And look, the Russians tried that with the N1, and it blew up. But now you got Jeff Bezos, right?
I mean, uh-huh.
And they're taking him very seriously. And Bezos is delivering. He doesn't talk before he's really
before
ready
he
to
delivers.
Deliver.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's got his BE-4 engine almost ready for full-scale testing early next year. So, it's a fascinating time to be covering space, and there's lots of questions.
You got another caller on hold in Florida, Jerry. That's, I guess, how I'll describe him until we get another Jerry. has an email for you. Have to say that I can see the creeping cancellation of SLS under a Hillary presidency. First, they say the New Glenn and the Falcon Heavy with Raptor upper stage can handle any payload the Block 1 SLS can handle and cheaper. So the Block 1 gets a flight of two, then gets canceled. Then they say that the new Armstrong and its NITS can handle anything the Block 2 SLS can handle and cancel that. So there's a lot of space in between all that happening, Jerry.
I will tell you what the attitude of Congress to that, I believe, would be, and this comes from discussions with actual members of Congress and people familiar with how Congress acts, is that the New Glenn announcement by Bezos, which to me didn't get enough attention even in the space meeting, because I thought that was really a big deal, just this really large rocket that he was talking about, it got no attention whatsoever in Capitol Hill. They're not going to really believe what Bezos is doing until it starts flying. Would a Hillary Clinton presidency, if they could, you know, sign something and cancel SLS without a big political blowback, would they do that? I think they probably would. But there's a huge political blowback. So that's not a fight that either president, I think, is going to want to undertake. There's just no, why would you put all of your political chits on canceling SLS, a program that the American public, you know, which doesn't get too deep into this stuff, looks at it and says, this is a good thing. NASA has built rockets for 50 years. They landed on the moon. Of course NASA should be building a rocket and spacecraft. They're our space agency. Why are we taking this away from them? This doesn't make any sense. So I agree with the email that eventually these rockets are going to do everything that SLS is promising, probably at a much lower cost than with reusability. But you're going to have to show Congress before
you're going to have to
demonstrate it.
Yeah. Let's see who your caller is. Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you and where are you?
Yeah, this is Jim from Southern California.
Hi. Jim or Tim?
Jim with a J.
Okay. Go ahead, Jim.
Hey, David, again, thanks for just your passion for this show. I don't think people appreciate how much time it costs to produce this. And Eric, just a great reporter for the space community. Eric, my question is, and you've touched a little bit about it earlier on in various segments here, but I was just kind of interested to get your prediction on how the end of life of the ISS will be, political pressure, timeline, international pressure, and what would come after that.
I wish I had the answer to that question, and I'm here in Houston where the program is managed, so I probably ought to know. But NASA obviously has made it clear they'd like it to fly through 2028. The question is, do the partners want to go along? There's been rumblings from Russia that they're not interested after 2024. Japan, it's my understanding, has signaled that they're not interested after 2024. I don't know where European Space Agency is. I don't know where Canada is. But there would be some kind of a fight to keep it going to 2028, although I suspect that in some form or fashion it may go. I cannot see any private entity taking over the International Space Station. The primary reason for that is that Boeing is the contractor for space station operations, and their
you know, they're expensive, right? It's more than $1 billion a year, I believe. Maybe I'm wrong, but it's a lot of money every year to keep the station operational, and Boeing has that contract, you know, regardless, it's my understanding. And so to have another private entity come in and say, we're going to take over the space station, you know, the U.S. side of it, I don't see that happening. And so NASA's been trying to figure out, you know, find a private company or sort of, you know, come fly your stuff on the space station. We've seen it with Bigelow to sort of try out your ideas for making a buck in space. And that's great, and NASA's to be commended. And it may work out. I certainly hope it does. It's just so far no one has kind of found the killer app that pays for the expensive launch costs and facility costs in space. And so NASA's talking about some kind of a private space station, and it may just be like a Bigelow module or something even simpler than that, sort of filling the space of low Earth orbit after station. But we'll have to see if that actually comes about. But, you know, it's a good question. You know, I just know there's a lot of sentiment within NASA. And I would think there would be the same thing within the Hillary Clinton presidency. I can't speak for Trump, but I have talked to some advisors for Clinton about the space station. It was started by her husband, right? I mean, he kept the station. So I also believe that she would be pretty strongly supportive of that. And sort of maybe making some effort over the next 4 years to try and extend it beyond 2024.
All right. Well, thanks for your insight. And again, great show today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so you have an email from Mark Whittington in Houston, and he says, listen to this one. Trump is touring KSC next week and will be a participant in an aerospace roundtable. Will he roll out a space policy?
Well, wouldn't that be great? I don't know.
Jerry, what do you hear about that? I know you're a Clinton fan, but what do you hear about Trump touring your backyard next week? And are you going to monitor that for us? So I did not know that. So, Mark, thank you for that little bit of information. That will be interesting to see if he puts forth some kind of space policy to try to, you know, win over Florida. So I wish he would put forward a space policy.
Well, I'll tell you something interesting. I had a conversation, I guess it was last week, with someone who was at OSTP and very deeply involved in the early years of the Obama space policy. So this person was on the front lines of that and made the point that, you know, when you're president and you talk about space, the space community is going to pick apart whatever you say and say, well, we can't do that for this reason or this is dumb or whatever. And the general public is going to say, or the decision makers are going to say, why is he talking about space? It's so low on the, you know, it's so low on the priority of the national interest. And the last person to kind of talk about space in any kind of way in a presidential way was Newt Gingrich when he was running, and he got killed. And you know, his plan wasn't bad. It was basically, you know, we should try to commercialize the moon, which is, you know, where I think everything is headed. So it will be really interesting to see what Trump says, if anything, about space policy. Although, you know, he hasn't gotten too deep into policies before, so I'm not sure what to expect from that. But certainly something to watch.
Yeah, but Newt also wanted to make the moon the 51st state, which is where he kind of lost it with people. And then, of course, Romney really ridiculed him big time to try to get kudos up on him in Florida. So that was unfortunate, but you know, Newt's probably the most informed person around on space and commercial space. It's too bad he's not in some kind of a real active space role.
I totally agree with you on that. Gingrich is interested in space. He's well informed, and you know, I have been told that he would be one person that Trump, to the extent that he, you know, cared about space, would rely on Gingrich. So, you know, maybe there will be some moon talk. I don't know.
What else is happening other than the moon, Mars, Musk, big rockets? what else is on your space news reporting interest agenda that we should know about?
Well, the whole question of commercial crew, right? Boeing and Boeing just announced that they're going to be flying CS or Starliner no later now, well, a crew mission in
an operational mission at the end of 2018. And we don't know where SpaceX is. They told me last week that they, or maybe 2 weeks ago, that basically they're hoping to stick to the end of 2017, but you know, they're going to have to reassess with this with the second Falcon 9 accident.
Why is it taking so long? Why do these companies incur delays with everything?
It happens with almost every development program for a spacecraft or aircraft. The timelines are just too optimistic. I mean, Boeing is literally trying to integrate hundreds of components built by hundreds of different suppliers into the spacecraft, and so you have to do just an inordinate amount of testing. And that all takes, you know, takes a lot of time. And SpaceX is trying to do, you know, for some reason, commercial crew is not their, it doesn't seem to be their highest priority. I mean, it's, you know, so, there, I mean, or let me put it, it's one of many priorities they have in addition to reusable rockets, the ITS, all these other things they're trying to return to flight, that sort of thing. So, my question is, and I reported about a month ago that officials here in the ISS program were starting to talk about buying seats from Russia, Soyuz seats, to get to the space station for calendar year 2019. And that was pretty well sourced. Now, since then, Gerstenmaier has, and I was told at the time that the discussions hadn't gone up to headquarters yet. Gerstenmaier said last week, I think, he was quoted saying that they are not going to buy Soyuz seats in 2019. But I don't think that's the final word, because there's no guarantee that either Starliner or Dragon, Crew Dragon, are going to be ready for operational flights in 2019. And the fact that Boeing has now already delayed till December of 2018, its second delay, leads me to believe that there's probably a pretty good chance that they might slip again. And so, you know, that's one of the inner areas I'm watching very closely. Obviously, the astronauts that are going to fly in that are here in Houston. You know, I know some of them. And it's, you know, it's important to the space station that they get their people there. So we'll have to watch and see where that story goes. But that's one of the big things I'm watching.
Do they express any worry or concern to you about flying on commercial crew?
Who?
The astronauts. You said you talked.
Yes.
To they do.
I am told, this is an interesting little nugget, but so, you know, Dragon was going to land on land, and then all of a sudden they had some issues, and then they changed up. Now they've gone to, at least for the initial landings of Crew Dragon, are going to be in the water. And they've had some water intrusion problems with some of their commercial cargo capsules early on. And I'm told that, and again, this is from people who would know, but you know, I wasn't there. I can't personally verify this, and so it's I wouldn't say it's rumor, but it's not certainly confirmed fact. But I'm told that she came down for a meeting with the astronaut corps to discuss this. You know, the fact that they were going to water landings and so forth, and she was not well received, is what I was told. That decision. So, yeah, there. You know, astronauts are going to have some concern about both the vehicles, but. But Shotwell apparently had a pretty rough meeting here in Houston, and I don't know when exactly it was.
Well, just wear a bathing suit underneath your flight suit.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, we haven't landed in the water since Apollo. And there are lots of questions. I mean, in the Apollo, you know, some of the Apollo program missions and you know, the whole Gus Grissom thing before Apollo, there were some, you know, the water, you talk to the guys, and they're here in Houston too, right? The guys who used to go do water landings?
Uh-huh.
Talk to them about it, and you know, it's not as safe as landing in Kazakhstan, right, where you've just got miles and miles of open ground and the rescuers can get you right away in the water.
It's
kind of a different game, and so that's a new thing too that NASA and SpaceX are going to have to figure out, and it's not a trivial issue. So
of course, we landed.
There's lots of interesting issues around commercial crew.
Yeah, and we landed in the water with full U.S. Navy support. So I guess you'd have full U.S. Navy support for a commercial crew mission coming back. That would be a government mission.
That's an excellent question. I would say probably, but I don't I don't have an answer. I probably should.
But that's probably pretty.
I can do with that, David.
That's pretty costly to have a destroyer or a cruiser or something out there, and then you got to have it nearby, and you got to have the helicopters ready, and you know it's actually a big production to land on water.
Without question.
You know, and they put divers in the water, put flotation collars on it. Maybe it's more streamlined today. I don't know.
That's a very good question. As a reporter, I probably ought to go figure that out, huh?
Yeah, and then let us know. You know, nobody's landing on water right now, are they? Except in
That's
Hollywood.
Right.
You know, on the one thing they landed on water, and she, you know, swam up and walked off the beach or something, remember?
Yeah.
What's her name? I can't even think of her name right now. Never got her hair messed up in Zero G. Any other great stories or things you're looking for toward the end of the year that we should know about?
I mean, you know, there's so much going on. It's hard to do it justice. I mean, I guess just the one thing I would say that was, you know, really striking to me in the last and recently, and to see what they're going to do going forward was the Blue Origin, you know, launch abort system test in mid-flight when they were able to recover the rocket afterward. I mean, that was very impressive. And to my sort of eyes and the people I talked to, you know, that really suggested, hey, they've got a very robust, you know, launch system here. They've got very smart engineers working there, and, you know, watch this space because, you know, the company, you know, you could raise questions about whether SpaceX has the resources to bring about, you know, let alone the ITS, even the Falcon Heavy, right? They're going to probably fly that, but, you know, it's because they have a lot of, you know, investment from private sectors, and they're getting, you know, they developed the Falcon Heavy cores with NASA money, the Falcon 9 rocket. But Blue Origin doesn't have any of those problems, right? The way Rob Meyerson described it once is, like, they'll sit around, they'll have a meeting, and they say, well, you know, I think we're going to need this, right? And Bezos will be there, and he'll just say, okay, go get it. You know, I mean, it's
different.
He's got $55-60 billion, depending on the value of Amazon stock, third or fourth richest man in the world, and Amazon's only getting more profitable. So, or, you know, it's only getting more valuable in terms of its stock price. So that's a company to watch. And when they say they're going to build the new Glenn rocket, you know, I think they mean it, right? And when you do something like that launch abort test and you land the rocket afterward, after it sort of comes out of the smoke and fire and flies off into space, you know, that's really impressive. So, you know, let's watch and see if they start putting people on that next year, which is what they're talking about.
Can you stay for three more emails that I've got for you?
Let's maybe do one or so. I've got to get going here in just a minute.
Okay, so one is just a quick comment. Jerry's going to be at the Trump thing. He'll let us know what's going on. Not sure what's public or not. So keep us posted. And then the other one I'll choose to read is Connie says SpaceX seems to be overextended. Do you think that's a big factor? Blue is not overextended. Have you been over to see any of the Blue tests at the Texas launch site, and any progress or any word on when Brownsville will come online?
On when what will come online?
Brownsville, the SpaceX launch site.
In Brownsville, okay.
Yeah.
All right, let's tackle those in reverse order. Brownsville, I was down in South Texas a couple months ago for a family vacation, and I sort of inquired about SpaceX of whether there was anything for me to go over there and see, and I was told the answer was no. I think that's on hold. That goes in line with Connie, was that her name?
Correct.
Yeah, her question about SpaceX being overextended. And I unfortunately, I think that is to some extent the case. I wrote for Ars a piece about a while back, a month or two ago, kind of basically saying that they really ought to be focusing on commercial crew, because that's where the majority of their revenues are coming from now. And that's, you know, if you want to make a statement to the world that you're a force to be reckoned with, you become the first company to put, you know, astronauts in orbit on your rockets. You beat Boeing and you do it safely and so forth. But they're trying to do that. They're trying to do commercial launches on Falcon on the Falcon 9. They're trying to, you know, continue to do reusable. They're trying to build the Falcon Heavy. They're trying to build components of the ITS with the Raptor engines and other projects. And so to some extent, I think they are overextended. And I love what they're doing. It's just they're trying to do a lot. And Blue Origin is more focused on, you know, building out the BE-3 engine and the new Shepard and then taking those ideas and scaling them up to New Glenn.
Have you been over to the Blue site? Can you get in and see their test?
No, I have not. I have asked, and I got to go to the Blue Origin factory in Kent, Washington in March,
uh-huh.
which was a darn impressive place. It was kind of like a small scale version of Michoud, to my eyes. But you could see the capsules that they were building for future flights, and there you could see the New Shepard propulsion modules that they were building, and then they had the BE-4 engine, and it was pretty cool. I have not been to the site in West Texas. No media has. You can go and kind of park on the road from a really distant vantage point and watch, but I haven't done that yet.
Okay.
Hoping they open it up soon.
Eric, thank you very much for being with us and updating us, and I look forward to your next visit down the road on the space show. This was really interesting, and we certainly are thankful for your time today.
Oh, I enjoyed it, and be happy to come back anytime.
Okay. Take care, and have a great week. And listeners, that's it for today. We thank Eric Berger and all of you who called and emailed. And everybody have a terrific week. Check the space show schedule, and you'll see what our programming is for the balance of the week. Thank you all. Goodbye from Eric Berger, the space show, and myself.